This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica, and today I'm bringing you a conversation that I had with Jack Queen. He's a legal correspondent specializing in politically charged cases, and he writes for Reuters. And we really did talk about some politically charged cases. You can bet who they were about. Their last names of the defendants end with Trump and Biden. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. Please, as always, rate, review, and subscribe. So, Jack, I'm so glad you're here. And I think we're going to focus on two big recent trials that you have covered, the hush money trial involving former President Trump, and also the trial against Hunter Biden. And I actually want to start with the more recent one first, the Hunter Biden trial. And I'm wondering if you could bring us back and explain why this case actually ended up going to trial. A lot of people thought there's a plea deal on the table and he was going to avoid this whole issue having to go to trial, and now we're waiting on a sentencing to see if he will face time behind bars.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was a plea deal on the table. In fact, the papers were signed, essentially. And I was actually at the hearing in Delaware federal court about a year ago when, you know, and me and all the other reporters in the room, we were expecting this to be, you know, sort of pro forma type of hearing, you know, 15 minutes or so, judge basically just approving the deal. But what ended up happening, to everyone's surprise, was the judge said, wait a minute, I don't like what I'm seeing here. Basically, her main issue with it was Hunter Biden was going to take, as part of this deal, he was going to get a non-prosecution agreement where prosecutors were going to agree to not prosecute him for a range of other crimes. And as a courtesy to the judge, which was an interesting thing, they provided her with the agreement, which technically she doesn't need to actually approve or even see at all. You know, these types of non-prosecution agreements are basically contracts between prosecutors and defendants. They don't need to be approved by judges. But they provided it to her anyway, and she took issue with the scope of it. And she started probing about, you know, the extent to which Hunter Biden would be getting immunity for all sorts of other crimes, potentially violations of, you know, foreign lobbying laws and things like that. And under her questioning, it basically revealed a pretty big disconnect between prosecutors and Hunter Biden's legal team over the extent of the immunity this deal would have offered him. And so basically that torpedoed the entire thing. And now where we're at is, well, of course, Hunter Biden ended up having to go to trial on charges of lying on federal background check forms when buying a firearm, lying about his drug use, then illegally possessing that gun. That case was in Delaware. And then a second case is still pending against him over unpaid taxes in California. And that's set to go to trial in September. So it looked like initially, you know, he was going to have a pretty favorable deal for himself. I think some of his critics would say it was a sweetheart deal. I don't think that's accurate. But basically, the judge overseeing the case torpedoed the whole thing. And now, instead of just a pretty straightforward plea deal, we have these two criminal cases.
I remember that day, and it was fascinating because, Jack, as you know, many people thought, well, this plea deal is just going to go through. And when it did start to unravel, that was actually quite surprising. And it was surprising to me that there was no meeting of minds with lawyers on this level. And I'm wondering if that was just how the trial proceeded, where there was maybe a breakdown in communication between the prosecution and the defense, or did it surprise you that it seems like on a fundamental issue of, is this plea deal everything, there wasn't agreement walking into a federal courthouse?
Yeah, it was quite remarkable. The fact that they weren't on the same page about such a basic and critical question about a plea deal, right? Which is the scope of the immunity. I mean, the immunity is sort of the whole ballgame here at the end of the day. And yeah, I think it sort of almost comes down to some imprecise legal writing and maybe just, I don't know, over the course of their long running negotiations, they sort of just got lost in the sauce. And then suddenly you have a third party looking at it and it reveals basic things that they sort of assumed they were on the same page about, but weren't. As far as, you know, to the extent that might have extended to the trial, you know, funny thing about the trial is that Hunter Biden's lawyers, even after the plea deal collapsed, they continued to insist that it remained in effect because the papers were all signed.
Right.
And prosecutors did not agree with that position. But as far as, and they preserved this issue for appeal, so it's going to be an issue on appeal. But as far as Hunter Biden's legal team is concerned, the plea deal is in place and he was immune from this entire trial. So that was an area of disconnect for sure. I think in terms of the legal theories from both sides coming into this trial, one of Hunter Biden's main arguments was that, you know, this statute, in addition to being unconstitutional on Second Amendment grounds, which is another issue we can get into that I think is pretty interesting, but and to back up, the statute makes it illegal for people under federal law, for people who are drug users, to own firearms. So his argument here was that one of his main arguments was that this is just unconstitutionally vague, this statute. There's no fair notice here, because what exactly does that mean to be a drug user, right? I mean, does that mean on the day that I purchased the gun, had I smoked crack on that day? Is it within a week? Is it within a month? Has it ever, you know, what is the definition of that? And how is the defendant supposed to be on notice whether or not they're breaking the law, which is, you know, one of those tent poles of fairness in the criminal justice system, is the idea of notice. And so that was really the fundamental issue at trial, right? I mean, on the one hand, it's pretty straightforward. Was Hunter Biden a drug user? Well, yeah, you look at the evidence. He's texting people about smoking crack. There's videos of him smoking crack. There's all sorts of evidence of him smoking crack. But again, what's the relevant timeline we're talking about? And so the judge ultimately decided, I forget the exact language she used, but her perspective was, if he had been using drugs within reasonably significant close period of time, she worded it differently, but that's basically the idea. Whereas Hunter Biden's lawyers, basically their argument was that pretty much as long as he hadn't smoked crack the day that he purchased the gun or within a week of him purchasing the gun, then he did not qualify as a drug user, and therefore he didn't lie when he ticked no on that form saying he wasn't a drug user.
This is really interesting. I want to get into it in terms of where the defense did make arguments here and where they put up the most vigorous defense, because it does look like kind of an open and shut case. We have his autobiography. He talks about being a drug user. There's texts about him being a drug user. He fills out a form that says, no, I'm not, so that he can buy the gun. It seems like a really strong case. But as you mentioned, there are, I think, two buckets that I'd like to focus on. And one is what you brought up first, which is this issue of vagueness. And did he understand himself to be a drug user at the time? And or is the definition of the law so broad that you can't prosecute anybody under it because they don't know whether or not they should be qualified as a drug user? And nobody does. It's just void for vagueness. And then the other is this Second Amendment issue. But just staying with the vagueness issue for a moment, what was the outcome here in terms of whether or not Hunter Biden had to know that he was lying on the form and or know that he was a drug user? Because I know that there were some significant arguments about what level of knowledge he really needed. And again, we're talking about a 3-count case, 2 counts of lying on a federal form, 1 count of being in possession of a gun when he shouldn't have been able to. So what was that level of knowledge or intent that he needed on both of those issues?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so prosecutors did need to prove that, one, he knew that he was a drug user, and two, that he knew he wasn't supposed to be able to buy a gun, and that, you know, basically that he knew he was a drug user and he knowingly lied about it on this form. And that's a pretty high burden to meet. And, you know, as you mentioned, yeah, there was on its face mountains of evidence, it seemed, to show that, yes, he was clearly a drug user. And, you know, it's important to note his legal team never disputed the fact that he was an addict, that he, you know, had long struggled with crack cocaine and alcohol use. But their whole point was that, look, prosecutors have all of this evidence of his extensive drug use between the years 2015 and 2019. You know, you mentioned the texts, the book, his own words, also testimony from 3 of his former romantic partners, his, you know, his ex-wife, his former girlfriend, all of whom are talking about him smoking crack, in some cases within weeks of his purchase of the gun. But the defense said that there is this key gap in all that evidence, which is about the week, 2 weeks around the period in October 2018 when he bought the gun. So their argument is that since they have all this evidence elsewhere, but not in this critical period right around the time that he bought the gun, they can't prove that he was, one, that he was even using drugs during this time period, and two, it would be reasonable, they say, to infer that since he wasn't using at this time, that he did not consider himself to be an active drug user. And I think that was probably their strongest argument there, because, you know, if you can sort of game it out in your head, it seems reasonable to think that, okay, even if someone had been addicted to crack for a very long time, say they stopped and they had gone a week, 2 weeks without smoking, and they went out and bought a gun, it would be, you could make the argument that it would be reasonable for them to consider themselves no longer drug users, right? I haven't used in 2 weeks. I'm done with this forever. I'm clean, regardless of whether or not they ended up relapsing and smoking crack again later, as Hunter Biden did. So I think that was probably the crux of the defense case right there. You know, it also was interesting because it comes down to also this question of how addicts conceive of themselves, right? How they define their own drug use. Like there was a lot of evidence about how Hunter Biden describing himself as an addict, as a drug user. And, you know, his defense team would say, well, this is what all addicts describe themselves as. They all describe themselves as addicts, even if they're clean. So that's not relevant. And, you know, ultimately, that was just a question for the jury, right? Their judgment about whether, like, what constitutes being a drug user, how drug users describe themselves, and what we can reasonably infer about all of that. I mean, ultimately, it was a very, I would say, subjective question that was going to the jury, despite the black and white nature of it all.
Absolutely, in terms of how we define ourselves and how we identify at any given point in time. And that certainly, as you said, did seem to me to play a big role at trial. But there was another defense argument that didn't play much of a role at trial, because my understanding is the judge said, no, you can absolutely move forward with these charges. And I'm talking about the Second Amendment argument here. And so I've written about this a little bit. We have the son of the Democratic president who's pushing for more gun control measures, as I understand it, arguing that under a 2022 Supreme Court decision called the Bruin decision, where the court laid out a new and more difficult standard for the government to satisfy when it comes to gun control restrictions, we have Hunter Biden saying, you can't actually prosecute me under this law because it violates the Second Amendment. And I'm wondering if you could flesh out a little bit, you know, is that an accurate portrayal of what we see here of the argument, and where are we on that argument? Because my understanding is that it was not allowed to be brought up during the trial, that what the judge said is, this federal statute is valid, we are moving forward, and that it's an issue on appeal for the Third Circuit right now.
Right. Yeah. It raises the remarkable prospect of a case captioned USA versus Biden at the Supreme Court becoming one that invalidates a federal law restricting gun ownership. Would be an interesting turn. But yeah, basically, the argument is that on its face, it seems like it would have a pretty decent chance with this very conservative Supreme Court that takes a very expansive view of the Second Amendment and gun rights. And you're right, pre-trial, this was an issue that Hunter Biden raised, and it went to the Third Circuit. But basically, it didn't come up at trial at all, because the Third Circuit said, look, you can go ahead and proceed to trial on this, and we'll come back to it later. Which, you know, unfortunate outcome for Hunter Biden. I think he and his lawyers would say, well, it's not really fair to just say, go ahead and we'll come back and fix this later if we decide this law is unconstitutional. But that's what the courts decided. And so that's still going to be working its way through the appeal process. I don't know exactly where it is right now, but I think it's safe to say that he has a decent chance on appeal on those Second Amendment grounds. I'm not sure about the void for vagueness. Maybe that's a win or two. He's obviously going to appeal on several other grounds, just, you know, as all defendants do. All sorts of issues come up at trial that they say, you know, were errors by the judge, things that were unfair. But as far as his chances on appeal, I would hazard that the Second Amendment argument, it might be one of his strongest ones.
Well, I agree, but I suspect it will largely depend on what happens in the next few weeks in the Supreme Court. As you know, the court is about to hand down a decision where it's going to interpret that 2022 case, and it's a case called Rahimi that deals with whether or not somebody's subject to a domestic violence restraining order can be prohibited under federal law from owning a gun. And I think the court is going to have to clarify that standard that they laid out again 2 years ago. And my guess is that Hunter Biden's appeal is in a bit of a holding pattern until we have more guidance from the Supreme Court on what exactly the current standard is and how we evaluate the constitutionality of gun control restrictions. Jack, before we leave the Hunter Biden trial, very few people were actually inside following it. And I'm wondering if you could share something where you think you just couldn't sense X, Y, or Z based on watching the reporting or listening to the reporting. Is there something that was maybe lost in the discussion of the trial and you wish people knew about, or something that just you think is worth emphasizing as somebody who followed it much more closely than, frankly, I think anybody listening?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the main things that I would say from being in the room is that the jurors were very bored by this trial. Mm. And I think it sort of goes to both prosecutors and the defense in this regard, in that it was just this very exhaustive, oftentimes duplicative slog through Hunter Biden's personal struggles with crack cocaine use and alcohol addiction. There were a lot of sordid details. There could have been a lot more, judging by what we've seen publicly of the contents of Hunter Biden's laptop. But I think to jurors, I almost sensed a sort of exasperation with it. And there were times when I saw a couple of them almost nodding off as we were just continuing to slog through all of these records. And you know, that's always a bad sign when you see a juror. I mean, I saw at least one juror quite literally about to nod off during the trial. And so I think that sort of maybe speaks to, you know, I don't want to say that this wasn't a serious case. I mean, obviously, you know, it's three felony counts, and, you know, Mr. Biden was convicted of three felony counts, and, you know, that's always serious. But I do think that this was an unusual trial in terms of the extent of the evidence and how deep both sides went into it, because of all the scrutiny around this case. And because also, you know, let's not forget, this came from a special counsel investigation, right? So this is not your run-of-the-mill false statements illegal gun possession case, right? I mean, in terms of the amount of resources devoted to this investigation, it's astronomical compared to what you'd normally see for this type of case. And I think that was ultimately borne out at trial. This boatload of evidence about this, and what is ultimately, I would argue, you know, not the biggest infraction, or at least not the type of crime where you would see this much evidence normally introduced. And so I think that was something that the jurors were responding to, was like, oh my gosh, really? More of this?
That's interesting, because it's a case that a lot of people, again, watched on TV, watched endless updates, and inside the courtroom, as is so often the case, it sounds like it wasn't quite as spicy and exciting. And maybe that, at least not for the jury, and maybe that brings us to another case where people viewed it as maybe not as important as other cases, another case where at least one person potentially nodded off in the courtroom. And of course, I'm talking about the hush money trial. And so to move to the hush money case, we all know that that brought another conviction, another historic conviction. We're talking about the conviction of former President Trump, and he was charged in a fairly, I think, complicated charging document, which dealt with the idea that he repaid Michael Cohen, his former fixer, for payments that Michael Cohen made to Stormy Daniels in order to try to buy her silence about her story of allegedly having an affair with the former president right before the election, in the wake of the Access Hollywood tapes, and right before we went to the ballot box. And as I understand it, that case, typically falsification of business records would typically be a misdemeanor. It's kicked up to a felony because the prosecution was able to demonstrate intent to commit or conceal another crime. And that other crime, and I wanted to ask you about this, could be one of three things. And my understanding is the jury instruction actually said you can find either that the other crime is federal election law violations, state election law violations, or tax evasion, tax issues. And I think that's where the charges were. Could you talk to us a little bit just to begin about what was it like to cover that trial, the first trial in our nation's history, the first criminal trial of a former president?
Yeah, well, just logistically, it was quite interesting. We had to get to the courthouse very, very early. Luckily, with Reuters, we had two reserved spots, one in the courtroom, one in the overflow room. Still had to get there very early. Multiple layers of security, bags hand searched, every single pocket, nook, and cranny. There was Secret Service all over the place. Our movements were very, very tightly controlled in the building, and the entire 15th floor where the trial was held was basically locked down. At times it felt like we were inmates almost. Other journalists. It was. You got used to it to some degree, but also you didn't. And just the police barricades everywhere, protesters, not huge crowds. This is Manhattan, after all. It's not exactly Trump country, but the crowds did get pretty big towards the end. So that definitely created an air of drama to it. You know, every time Mr. Trump walked in and out of the courtroom like a boxer entering the ring or whatever, he was escorted by his Secret Service. And so that was all pretty dramatic. But, you know, as you mentioned, in terms of the case itself, we did have some scandalous testimony by Stormy Daniels, you know, a lot of lewd details and stuff about this alleged sexual liaison. But, you know, what was interesting to me was that, you know, they brought up Stormy Daniels to testify about this alleged affair. But the question of whether or not the affair even happened is sort of irrelevant to the charges, right? Because the charges are ultimately just about falsifying records related to these payments. And it doesn't actually matter if the affair happened. I mean, Mr. Trump said it didn't, and that he only paid her because he wanted to avoid embarrassing his family. And so that sort of begs the question of maybe why prosecutors even called Stormy Daniels, or at least called her for that extensive testimony with all of these lascivious details. And, you know, that actually led to the defense to ask for a mistrial after her testimony, because they said that a ton of her testimony was just inflammatory details about him smacking her on the rear with a rolled up magazine and stuff like that. And you know, the judge seemed to, you know, have some sympathy for that argument. He was saying, yeah, please rein in this witness, Daniels, please keep your answers very focused on the questions that are being asked. Now, of course, the judge denied the motion for a mistrial, but I think, you know, that could be actually a fertile ground for appeal. It's certainly something that Mr. Trump's lawyers are going to argue. I think, honestly, his defense lawyers, they weren't objecting all that often during Ms. Daniels' testimony, and I think that might have been intentional. I think they might have wanted to let her sort of go as far off the leash as they could while preserving objections for appeal, because, you know, that's the type of thing that can sometimes get convictions in trouble on appeal, is when, you know, testimony goes outside the scope and it looks to appeals court judges like it was just inflaming the jury for no reason. And especially since, as I mentioned, the question of whether or not the affair even happened is sort of irrelevant to the actual charges.
So I know we have very different roles. You're a journalist and I was analyzing / commenting on this trial. And I had a different reaction right after I heard about the testimony to one that I had a little bit after reflecting on it. So my initial reaction, as you said, it doesn't actually affect the charges, whether or not the affair even happened. The charges don't turn on that. It's about whether or not the business records were falsified when Trump paid Cohen. Was that for legal expenses or was it a reimbursement to pay Cohen for the payments that he made to Daniels for her silence? But then in reflecting on it and all of the details that she shared, I thought, actually, this does make a difference because this is the story that they didn't want the voters to hear. And so my feeling was, this might have been hugely impactful for the jury because they are able to hear, and it's those little details that make a story credible. They're able to hear what she would have said on, you know, pick your network, pick your interviewer. But again, right after the Access Hollywood tape came out, right before we're going into voting. And I'm wondering if you thought that that was particularly impactful for the prosecution. Again, we could argue whether or not it's appropriate that it did it go beyond the scope or did it not. But in giving it a few moments thought, I thought, oh, this brings it to life. This brings it off of the business ledgers and into why would they have been so eager to bury this story?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a fair point. And I think it's also worth noting, too, that as you mentioned, all the granular details, that those are the types of things that make testimony much more believable. And I think a big part of the calculus for prosecutors was probably, okay, well, since Trump denies that this affair even occurred, if we can put Stormy Daniels on the stand and she gives very credible testimony with all these details to convince the jury that, okay, it did happen, then that harms Trump's credibility as a defendant, right? Because then if the jury believes that the liaison occurred, then that means that they also have to think that Trump is a liar. So there's certainly a good strategic reason to do that. I think, but in terms of the cumulative effect of it, I see your point. I don't want to ultimately try to get into the jurors' minds about how they reacted to it. And, you know, as I mentioned, to the extent that they believed her and found her credible, then that certainly undermines Trump's credibility as a defendant. But, you know, the other risk there, too, I think, was that this whole case was kind of, it just, the contours of it and all the details were quite sordid, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think an interesting thing about it was that there wasn't really a clear victim in this case, which is sort of unusual for criminal trials, particularly with things like white collar offenses, like falsification of business records. You know, you don't have some business owner or customer or someone who was cheated and lost their life savings or someone like that. The closest thing we get to a victim in this case is Stormy Daniels. And she's not really a victim because ultimately she was party to a business transaction where she got $130,000. And, you know, she wasn't really tricked by Donald Trump or anything like that. And, you know, I think that was a tricky thing for prosecutors to try to pin down, because there was this testimony where they were trying to elicit and where she was saying that she felt sort of victimized in various ways, in particular that, you know, this was a grubby encounter that she found really unpleasant and all of that, on all of this. But she also clarified that she never felt intimidated or she didn't consider herself to be a victim of sexual assault with this with a particular encounter. And so that was kind of tricky. And then you also have, you know, testimony from her lawyer who, you know, he's not exactly the most sympathetic figure either. And so I guess that was part of the disconnect, is like when you put up someone like Stormy Daniels in this case, you would expect for her to be providing victim-inflicted testimony, but that's not really the role that she played in this case, because nobody really played the role in that case except for the American voter, according to the prosecutor's narrative, right? And you can't put the median American voter on the stand. You can't put someone on the stand who says, oh, I wouldn't have voted for him if I knew about this. I mean, maybe you could, but it's not really feasible.
So, yes. I mean, I think in part when people heard about Stormy Daniels' testimony, you're right that there were aspects of it that were troubling. And while she didn't say, I was raped or I was sexually assaulted, there were, I don't know if undertones or undercurrents is the right word, but there were aspects of it that were disturbing. And so mm-hmm, I think she was, at the very least, a sympathetic witness. But as you said, the theory of the case here was the victim is the American public. The victim are, it's all of us. It's the voters who didn't get this information prior to voting. And I'm wondering, as we said, it's a complicated case. I think the way it was charged, obviously, it ended up well for the prosecution. I personally thought it was quite risky. But were there moments when you were in the courtroom where you thought, wow, the prosecution really landed a punch here?
I think. In terms of prosecutors landing punches, I think, you know, initially I thought the Daniels testimony was going to be a big win for them, and I found it very compelling. I thought she was a great witness, and I think the defense did a pretty good job on cross-examination, and I think the longer she spent on the stand, the less good it was for prosecutors for the reasons that I mentioned. You know, the Cohen testimony, I thought, was good for them in large part because of Cohen, because I thought on cross-examination, he did a really good job of keeping his cool under just exhaustive round after round of cross-examination. And frankly, I mean, you know, Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, on cross-examination, was trying to humiliate Michael Cohen and piss him off and get him to lose his cool and lack out, and, you know, those types of things can shred your credibility as a witness before a jury. He never did that. He was constantly being confronted with his own, you know, rap sheets, his criminal convictions, his history of lying, all these embarrassing things he said in the past and so on and so forth. And every time he's just like, yes, yes, just acknowledging it, sort of monotone, not losing his cool. So I think that was a moment that I thought was very helpful for the prosecution, because that bolstered his credibility from his own testimony, which I thought was some of the best evidence they had. The testimony from David Pecker, I thought was really good for them too, because, you know, this is a man who says he still loves Donald Trump and considers him a friend, and there's no bad blood between them. So unlike Michael Cohen, who, of course, you know, he clearly has animus towards Trump and he has potential reasons to testify against Trump. He's motivated to see a prosecutor, to see a conviction potentially. David Pecker's not like that. He has no interest in seeing Trump convicted. And his testimony was fairly damaging. You had the recording of the secretly recorded conversation of one of these meetings where they discussed the payment. You hear Trump in his own voice describing paying off Karen McDougal, who was a former Playboy model who prosecutors, she wasn't formally part of the indictment, but prosecutors say that they used a similar catch and kill scheme to bury a story that she had. So I thought all of that was pretty compelling for them.
Same question for the defense, because I think obviously you had a unique vantage point and things just land differently if you're there versus if you're reading about it. And I do think that you did an indispensable job of bringing us in the courtroom. But we still weren't there. So were there portions of the defense case where you thought this is a great moment for the Trump defense team, or maybe we're not getting to a conviction in this case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I did mention that I thought Michael Cohen did well on cross-examination, and he did. But that was also a time when Trump's lawyers did land a pretty good punch, I thought. Which was when they were questioning Michael Cohen about this phone call he says he had, which is backed up in phone call logs, right? This, he had a brief phone conversation with Trump's bodyguard. He says that during this time, he discussed the payment with him and gave him an update on it. And then, you know, Todd Blanche, I think, did a pretty good job of showing, actually, there's a lot of other circumstantial evidence that suggests that maybe this phone call was about something else entirely, which was about these threats that Michael Cohen was receiving, and he wanted to talk to Trump's bodyguard about it. Now, you can't say conclusively either way, in my opinion, what was actually discussed on that phone call, but it did cast some doubt on Cohen's testimony, and, you know, taken together with a larger context of, you know, him having admitted animus towards Trump, I think that was a good moment for the defense, for sure. I think, though, overall, and you asked for particular moments. I don't know if I can point to any particular moments for the defense, but I think overall the impression that I got, the most effective thing for them was really just chipping away at the lack of evidence of Trump intent in this,
yeah.
Right? Because there really wasn't much evidence, direct evidence, of Trump knowingly breaking the law here, which is a key thing. I mean, there's abundant evidence, I think, of, you know, he approved this, he signed off on it, whatever, but that's only part of what prosecutors need to prove, right? I mean, the key hurdle is that he approved this knowing that it was illegal, and critically, as you mentioned, the whole thing with the intent to intent to violate another criminal statute, whether it be, you know, election finance or campaign finance law or tax laws or things like that. He also needed to intend to break those underlying statutes. So you have effectively two layers of intent here, which is kind of unusual. And both of them are pretty high burdens to meet. And I don't think there was a whole lot of direct evidence at all that Trump knew this was illegal and did it anyway. Now, obviously there was a conviction anyway, and you obviously don't need him on tape saying, okay, let's do this in order to violate campaign finance law. Then, you know, I think prosecutors would say, and the jury clearly thought that, you know, the cumulative evidence, even if a lot of it might be circumstantial, was enough. But that was my thinking throughout the trial, was I was sort of waiting for prosecutors to show some hard evidence of Trump knowing that this was illegal. Again, that's really, really hard to do in any case. So it's not, you know, points against them for, you know, not having that, but still. And I thought the defense did a pretty decent job of really trying to underscore that and highlight it to the jury. I guess they didn't do a good enough job because they didn't win. But to me, that was kind of the crux of the defense case, was that where's the proof that he knew this was illegal?
And this is a commonality for both of the cases that we talked about, which is that showing knowledge or intent, knowledge in the case of Hunter Biden, intent in the case of Donald Trump. And I think I talked about the kind of double intent hurdles in the hush money case, as you mentioned. That is a high threshold for the prosecution. Ultimately, they were both able to clear it. But I think you're exactly right to focus in on the fact that juries often do convict when there's only circumstantial evidence. You often don't have the smoking gun, but that was the biggest opening for the defense. And so Jack Quinn of Reuters, thank you so much for joining us and walking through these two really high profile and complicated trials. You brought us inside the courtroom, which is invaluable, and your reporting was extraordinarily helpful. So I hope you'll come back because we know there'll be more trials.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.